Pam, and I'm an alcoholic. This is not my comfort zone, so I love getting in front of people and talking and acting stupid and all that stuff when I was drinking, and now that I'm sober, it just isn't my thing anymore. But my friends came here with me, so my sobriety date is July 2nd, 1998, and I'd like to share with you how I got here. And looking back, a lot of my story, how I grew up, I realized a lot of things just from the people in these rooms in this program. And a lot of it is I had a really good childhood. I had very strict parents, so I always thought I had it really rough. And when I came into this room and listened to the stories of some other people, I saw that I had very caring parents. My parents always worked. I grew up near the beach, San Pedro, Redondo Beach, Hermosa Beach. I lived at the beach most of my life. And there was a rule in our house. We had a three-date rule. So in high school, I never got to go study or never really got too involved with guys. And in a way, that was a good thing. My family always sat down and had dinner together. We had to do a current event. There was always a hot meal on the table. I lived very close to Palos Verdes, so there were the rich people up on the hill, and then there was the poor kids down at the bottom. But I never knew that. I never felt that growing up. And I look back now, and I had a very loving, good home. A lot of alcoholism in my family, but we never talked about it. All the grandparents died of either alcohol-related diseases or car accidents. I always thought my grandmas were really old when they died. And my father just died a couple years ago, and I was going through his belongings, and I saw that his mother was only 56 when she died. And now, that seems really young to me. But when I was in my last year of junior high school, I moved to Huntington Beach, and I love Huntington. I love the surfers. I love the bad boys. I like the guys that got kicked out of high school for smoking dope or not doing their homework or whatever. And that was really my introduction to I started drinking. Because of the three-date rule, I never really got into too much trouble. And Huntington Beach in those days was small, so if you got caught drinking, the police would follow you home. And it was usually a car full of girls. We'd be in Laguna Beach or Newport Beach. And they didn't even tell your parents. They just made sure you got home okay. But I really didn't get into any trouble. And I graduated in 1964, so Vietnam was going on, a lot of drugs, a lot of wild, crazy things going on, Monterey Pop Festival, all these things, and I participated in a lot of that. My high school class president, if anybody knows the surfing movies, that movie Endless Summer, that guy was, Robert August was my high school class president. So it was pretty wild times. And living in Huntington, that all I wanted to do, I was introduced to alcohol at that time, playing volleyball at the beach, and that's all I wanted. I wanted to live my life, marry a little surfer guy, play volleyball, drink beer, lay on the beach all day. That's what I thought life was, good life was. When I graduated, most of my friends either went to college or they had to get married. Three-date rule again. I didn't have to get married because I never got to date anyone long enough. And I got a good job right away for the a little Huntington Beach local newspaper, and I loved that job. I was introduced to a lot of entertainment. I got to go everywhere with the reporters, started drinking a little more. I moved out when I was 17. I couldn't wait to pay my own rent and just live on my own, although my parents lived right down the street. And LSD was a big thing at that time at the parties. I never drank the punch because LSD, for some reason, really scared me. I saw what it did to a lot of my friends, but I never saw anything wrong with my drinking. Started learning to manipulate and lie because I wanted to travel. And a lot of the places I wanted to travel were, I guess what you'd call underdeveloped countries, Central America, Mexico, Belize, and way back then it was a lot of turmoil then, and I always lied to my parents. I manipulated because I knew even at 18, 19 years old, they would not let me go. So that's another thing I learned through this program, how my pattern of lying and manipulating and conniving to get my way started at a very young age. Moved to Hawaii for a while. When I came back, got another good job. Was always a fast typist, and if you could type fast in those days, because they didn't have computers, you could always get a good job. And I would work just long enough to get an airline ticket to wherever I wanted to go next, and I'd move and be gone for a year and come back. Met my first husband in Belmont Shore. He was just getting out of his internship as a physician, and he got drafted. Vietnam still going on, and he was put on a hospital ship, so I got to remain living in Huntington Beach, and he was in the service for 4 years, and he was also a very good dart player, and he won us a lot of trips because he would win the United States competition. We'd get to go to Ireland, Wales to play darts. A lot of drinking again. And I remember, about our fifth year of marriage, he got 3 DUIs in 1 year. And they didn't do much to people back then, like the trouble I'm going to say I got into later. And I remember going to Malibu to pick him up. He was in jail. And I remember telling him, why do you think you have to drink to have fun? And little did I know that my life was to change drastically. I always felt less than with all the crowds we ran around with because they all had education. I had never been to college. I just didn't feel as good as everybody else. I finally enrolled in college. I got to go to UC Santa Barbara, and again, it was a lot of turmoil. I was there when they burnt down the Bank of America building. Most of you are probably too young to remember that, but believe me, it was fun. And there was a lot going on. And still wasn't drinking too much because I really, I was always a periodic drinker. I drank, I could go 2 days, a week, 2 weeks, a month easily. And that led to a lot of my problems later because we're in total denial. I always thought a drunk was one of those people that drank every day, shook every day, couldn't go to work, and it didn't happen like that for me. However, being married to a doctor, I had cramps a lot, and so I was introduced to the world of pharmaceuticals. And it was, only a couple of years ago, somebody told me that those pills they used to give us in my day for cramps were actually methamphetamine pills. And again, I'm manipulating, my conniving to get more and more pills. Because if the pill said, take one every 4 hours, I was going to take 4 every hour. Well, they disappeared real quick. And I could stay up late, study, go to school. But I did connive. I never forged anything or I didn't steal them. However, I knew every pharmacist in town. And I could say my husband was out of town and my prescription had expired. And I had all these places where I could go do this stuff. And my life started going downhill a little bit after I graduated, and I had decided that a good job for me was to substitute teach. And another thing I've learned only through this program and through my fourth and fifth step is that I did that for a reason. If you were hungover or wanted to drink that day, you just didn't answer your phone at 6 in the morning. And that's what I did. I was a substitute teacher for that reason, because if I was a full-time teacher, I would have to go to work every day, and that just wasn't in the picture. I divorced this man, and he was a good person. We're friends to this day, just didn't work out. We're both married to different people. So I had a period after that divorce where my life totally changed. I ended up with a nice little bungalow-style house in Ventura. I'm divorced. The social world had totally changed for me, but now I could finally drink like I really wanted to drink, and I was off and running. And within just a couple of years, I was getting the DUIs, blackouts. My slippery favorite place to drink was doing yard work. And I, of course, go get a six-pack or two of beer, and then eventually that would run out, and I'd have to get in my car and go get some more. And I always got busted by the Ventura police, like within a mile of my house. And my first DUI, I hadn't met my current husband yet. My first DUI, I was just scared to death. So I got an attorney, and he said, you know, it usually looks good in front of the judge if you go to those AA meetings and get these little cards signed, and the judge likes that. So I said, okay, I've not a clue what AA was. And I did that, and I got my first drunk driving around the holidays, and by the time it went to court, the judge said, you've never been in trouble before, happy holidays, we're going to let you go. And I couldn't believe it. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I thought I'd lose my license or something. So I remember treating myself and getting good and drunk that day. Not a clue that this was not a good sign. Within 2 months, I had another DUI, and they charged me for both of them. And I didn't know they could do that. They have a year to come back. So since they were so close together, my blood alcohol was very high. They nailed me for both. So started doing a little jail time, work furlough. Wasn't too bad. Met my husband now, kind of calmed down enough to where I thought he thought I was just a really nice little lady, which he did, I guess, because he married me. And I remember I would have blackouts, and I fell once, and he came home, and I had cut my head open, and I was laying on the floor, and I remember he said, do you think you might have a problem with alcohol? And I remember saying, I don't know. Do you think I did? We just had not a clue what this program was or what alcohol abuse was. Well, it continued to get worse and worse. We moved our business, relocated, bought a little ranch in Fillmore, and that was just the worst drunk time of my life because he was gone a lot. I just knew when he was gone, I would drink. A lot of blackouts. I just thought I was real clever when I'd go out to drink. It was a very small town, so there weren't that many bars, and I would put my pillow and a blanket in my car. Just in case. You must have done that, huh? Just in case. I was so drunk, I knew I couldn't drive home because I'm already looking at a couple drunken publics and a couple DUIs. And I just thought that was so clever. And still, not a clue. And I would sleep in my car all night, drive home in the morning, and expect my husband would say, where have you been? Or I'd make up something. I mean, we're very clever. And I remember I would look at him and think, how could he possibly believe what I'm telling him? And on the way over here, I was talking with my friends, and I don't know how we got on the subject. We got on the subject of ballet and symphonies and dancing. And my minor at college had been dance. And I took ballet for 15 years. And I finally got to the point, and was in the Nutcracker twice, and this is what alcohol did to me. We had a production coming up, and it was a beautiful Russian folk ballet. And 2 weeks before that production, I fell. I fell in my backyard drunk coming home, and I cut my ankle. And I don't know, I thought it was the same day, if it was 6 in the morning or 6 at night, I don't remember, but I waited way past the time one was supposed to wait to get stitches, and it became infected, and they couldn't stitch it, and I had this giant bandage on my ankle, and I remember going to that ballet studio and telling the ballet mistress and all my friends that I couldn't dance. And I just knew, they knew I was a drunk. I just knew it. And I have never to this day ever stepped in a dance studio again. And that was one thing I really gave up that I loved a lot. Because I'd rather drink than to dance. Another thing, when I graduated from college, one of the countries I went to was Guatemala, and I took backstrap weaving, and I was going to become a hand weaver. And that was going to be my profession. And I don't know if any of you have seen a loom. I bought a loom. Well, you have to be relatively sober to operate those things. And I had that loom, I bet, 10 years before I ever used it. Because I just could never stay sober long enough to figure out how to use it. So I gave that up. I remember the times that I was arrested, and my sister would have to take me the next day to wherever I lost my car, purse, jacket, you name it, always lost something. And in Fillmore, they were what I call the Mexican bars. They were these little bars out in the groves. And that's the only place that would let me come back in anymore. And just the look of mortification on my sister's face. And she'd look at me like, what is my sister doing in places like this? And that just became a real part of my life. I always was a blackout drinker. My poor husband, in just a couple weeks, we'll have been married 28 years, and I've been sober not even half of that. We left the beach, relocated our company to here. I moved to Springville, and my company is in Lindsay. And there's really no place to drink in Lindsay. And I've already got a few DUIs behind me, and I just hated it here. I love the ocean. I miss the ocean. It would seem like a good idea to drink to me. So if any of you have been to Lindsay, there used to be a place called Coleman's, and it was a restaurant. It was pretty nice. You could drink there, and then it burnt down. So I started going to these really divey places, really, really divey. And I was actually asked to leave. I won't even say the names of them, but if anyone's lived in Lindsay, they know where they are. And I was asked to please never come back. And then what I call my real story starts. I was taking some pills and drinking because that was my favorite thing to do, my two favorite drugs of choice, pain pills and alcohol taken together. And that was just the best feeling I can ever remember having. And I started... Well, my husband's really like getting mad at me at this point, making me sign contracts when I come home drunk. And God, I remember, the contract. So I promise if I ever drink again, I will pack my suitcase and I'll leave. And I go, okay, I'll sign the damn thing again. Because he said that as often as I said, I'm sorry, I promise I'll never do this again. I don't know why I do this, but I promise I'll never do it again. He did the contract thing just as many times. So I would always sign it. He never kicked me out. Nothing ever happened. And then one day, they always talk about the yes, and that's what happened. I was And we probably got in a fight or something, and so I was driving to the big town of Porterville to get drunk. Of course, I'm already drunk, and I got in an automobile accident, and I left the scene of the accident. So I was in big time trouble. And two girls were in the car. One woman was pregnant. Thank God they were okay. However, I don't know what got into me that I thought if I could make it back home to Springville, I would be okay. And the cops behind me, the lady that took my license and called the cops, was following, and I drove almost home. And I even did the speed limit. And I don't know, we just do crazy things, you know, and I just thought if I was in my own driveway, I'd be okay. Well, Springville's like not that big a town, and I got pulled over on a street where it's big excitement, so everybody came out, and I got arrested, and of course it was in the second page of the paper the next day. I mean, my whole life story in there. And but that was the start of my new life. And I just knew when they put me in the back of that police car, and I remember I had on these cute little sandals and my long hair and real long ponytail and this cute little summer dress and a little t-shirt, probably no bra. And that's how I got to go to jail. But I knew when they put those cuffs on me and put me in the back of that police car, and it was the 4th of July weekend, July 2nd, and they took me to jail, but as they were driving me, something in my head said, Jan, life as you know it is over. And I truly did not think I was going to stay sober. That was not in my plan. My life was over because I was going to kill somebody. I just almost could have killed those two ladies earlier. I was going to kill myself, or I was going to end up in prison for a long, long time because I had become a habitual drunk driver, and the court system does not like that stuff. So I got to spend, my husband did come to bail me out of jail, but they said it's a holiday weekend, and we're not letting anybody out because we're understaffed. So I got to stay in jail for 4 days, I think. That following Monday, I think they call it the tunnel, where you go walk under that tunnel and go, I see a couple heads going, uh-huh. We're chained at the waist, shackled at the feet, and shackled to 17 women were led through the tunnel to the courtroom. And I just thought, how did this happen to me? How did I get here? What am I going to... I didn't want to see my family again. I, honest to God, just wish they'd throw me away and lock the keys, because I did not want to tell my family one more time. Oh, my husband's so pissed. He didn't want to talk to me anyway. And I'll never forget the 4th of July was a Saturday. And I remember the girls in jail. I'd never been in jail before. They always let me out, and I had to go back and pay the fines and all that, but I didn't have to do jail time other than a night with everybody. But I remember the girls in jail said, oh, those AA ladies are coming tonight, and they bring cookies. And I went, I really still didn't know too much about AA, but I went, oh, nobody's going to come here on a holiday. And a woman from Visalia was, and that Asian eye, she came in and gave me my first big book. And I remember she put her arms around me and she said, honey, you don't have to live like this. Do you know anybody you can call? And I did know one person. Her name was Cheryl Williams, and her husband was Hal Williams, who was one of the drug court judges. And I called Cheryl from jail, and you have to call collect. That's like really embarrassing. I don't have anything to be embarrassed about. I called her and I told her I needed help, and she said, give me a call when you get out. We didn't know when that would be. And she said, and Jan, if you drink again, it's not my fault. She hung up on me. And I went, damn, what a bitch. So then I was scared in that jail. I was really scared. I like lost 8 pounds, I think, in like 4 days. But I got Hal was, got him as my attorney, and I was the only woman in that courtroom that day with an attorney. And I got released. I got out. The other girl that did exactly what I did, got in a hit and run. She was my bunk mate in that jail. She got sent to Chowchilla for 3 years. Life ain't fair. I know. I started seeing. And I was like, my husband was pissed that I wasn't put in jail because he couldn't trust me anymore. I, by the way, was in our company vehicle when I got in the wreck. So my company's being sued, of course. And I work with two other old-timers in the program, and they're really good guys. And I think my employees all at work, we only had like 10 or 12 employees, they took a group conscience, and I was not allowed to come back to work for a year till I could prove, because they would all lose their jobs if I lost my company. But I remember the night my husband picked me up in jail, and this is how self-centered I still was. When he picked me up, get out like at 3 in the morning, you know, and he's driving me home, and he told me, you are not allowed to work. You cannot have the checkbook. Obviously, I'd lost my driver's license. And I don't care what you do. I don't want to see you. We remained to live in the same house. However, we didn't talk too much. It was very uncomfortable. And I remember looking at this man and saying, don't you tell me what to do. And that's how, God, I was just so sick. I had not a clue. I still wanted him to see how hard things were for me. It was still all about me. I told Hal, my attorney, please get this over as soon as you can. I just want to go to prison. I was looking at 3 years because I was a habitual. And Hal knew Judge Roper. And one other woman had, I was in the third group of drug court. One other woman had come through with her main drug of choice being alcohol, and she opened the way for me. They gave me a chance. And I tell you, I had no idea what I was getting into. The year and a half program, I couldn't go to work anyway, so I did the DUI program at the same time. Had no car. My husband wouldn't talk to me. There was no bus. So I had to ride my bicycle up and down that hill almost 4 or 5 times a week, 40 miles round trip. And it was August. It was so hot. And the only reason I say that, you know, at first I wanted a lot of pity. People listened to me whine about having to ride my bike for about 2 months, and then they told me to knock it off. You know, they asked us, are we willing to go to any length to stay sober? And it finally got to where I truly thought, this is what I have to do to stay sober. Some of us are sicker than others. I was hitting all the early meetings, which one of them was an NA meeting, Friday mornings, because I could leave my house at 6 o'clock, make it there, get to a meeting, go to court, and be home, hopefully, before it was 120 degrees. And those guys really saved my life, too. They told me to quit whining. They weren't very nice to me, I didn't think. I go to that meeting to this day because it's important for me to go in and show other people that that drug court program can work. There were only two of us women in my class, and one of them is dead. Well, obviously, I'm not. She's dead, and three of the men are dead because of this disease. And I can only think of two of us that are still sober. So this is, you know, when I had about maybe a year, 2 years sobriety, I began to get that little confidence, you know, I'm okay, I don't need to go to as many meetings, a lot of things, a lot of us do. And I began to think I was in a place, a plane, where my husband wasn't, because I was learning to be honest. He still told lies. I was learning to say what was in my gut. He didn't. And I mean, I kind of got that little pissed off, you know, why do I have to do all this shit and he doesn't? And I just never thought he was at my level. And when they told me, Your family will watch what you do, and they will change along with you. And my husband wrote me a letter, and it was like a love letter. And he equated my disease as to having had this 15-year affair with Mr. Al K. Hall. And he knew that Mr. Al K. Hall loved me so much that he would wait for me. He would wait for me forever. He was very patient, and when I was ready, my husband knew that this disease would open its arms and say, "Welcome back. I will wait for you." And ever since that, I read it every year on my birthday. I have saved that letter. I'm ever reminded that this disease is right at my shoulder. And it's never going to let me go. I've got to continue to do my... I still travel a lot. I travel differently. I don't stay in the $4 room with meals included and a lock on the doors. I don't do that anymore. However, I do travel to these crazy places. And a lot of times I do it by myself. I'm always on that computer and I'm finding where the meetings are, because I've only been to one country, believe, that I could not find an AA meeting in. And I'm sure they were there. I just couldn't find it. Because if I'm out of my element and somebody can't see me, I can get back into the lie real easily again. And I can say, nobody will know what I do. So I need the protection that I have here. And I need to keep going to the meetings. I have a couple, I go to New Mexico a lot, I have a home group there. I can be gone 6-8 months, and when I walk in, I just got back, and we all say, "Hi, you're still here, we're all still here." And that is just so critical. My sponsor, a lot of crap happens in our sobriety too. That's why when they told me, just keep doing what you're doing, that's what I tell girls I sponsor. You gotta keep doing this stuff, and you gotta wait for the miracle to happen. I used to get so sick of hearing that baloney. Oh, all those little, those little things they hang on the walls. And, but it is so true. And about 3 years ago, I really hit a bottom in sobriety. I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to use. But I didn't want to be on this earth anymore. And I didn't tell anybody. And I just only recently shared this with people. My sponsor was dying of cancer. And I was angry at God. How could he take such a good person? And what was I going to do without her? My father had just died. My brother had both kidneys removed, and I was being considered as a donor. My company was being sued by the state of California, you name it. I was on a real pity pot thing. I just didn't have the guts to kill myself, but I thought about it. And I started watching the other people in the program, my home group, the other people, and they all were going through their own personal stuff, and they didn't drink and they didn't take drugs over it, and those were the people I clung to. And my sponsor was real close to dying. I think I had just fought 10 years, and I remember one of the gentlemen with like 30 something years said, why aren't you talking to her about this stuff? And I said, how could I talk to her about my stuff when she may be dead in 2 days? And he said, "Jan, don't you understand? Now is when she needs to hear it." And I started understanding when people said, "You just don't need the people in these rooms. They need to hear me." I used to not go to meetings on my birthday because I would be so embarrassed to get up and shy, and I didn't want to take a cake. And I finally had some lady kick me in the butt once and say, "Honey, this ain't about you. This is about you letting the new people know out there that this program works." And that's why it's critical that we do this. When my brother had his kidneys removed and I was being tested as a donor, I became real close. He lives outside of Atlanta. And I became close to a group there that I got to go to a meeting every day there. 7 a.m. they had a meeting. And it became my second home group. And I remember one day, one lady, she turned 40 years old. And she was whining and pissing. Well, I feel like such an old lady. And I just thought, I didn't get sober till I was 51, and my life started. My life got good. And I remember looking at her and just thinking, it only gets better. It only gets better. And, you know, there's just so many things I've learned in this program. I'm not the social person I was when I drank. I don't like getting up in front of groups. I don't like dancing, God, whatever I did on tables. I never remembered what I did, why they kicked me out of these bars. But obviously they had a reason. To have my sister tell me at Christmas time, the best gift you ever gave me was I got my sister back, still brings tears to my eyes. I'm allowed to drive with my grandkids in the car again. That was a no-no for many, many years. My sponsor, her, the day she died was 2 days ago, and instead of crying now, I've learned to look back, and again, it's only something I've learned in these rooms. I've learned to turn it around, and instead of be angry that such a good person was taken, I've learned to say, God, thank you for giving her to me for 10 years. And we can always turn things around, and that's what I've learned to do. And just in closing, I keep thinking this thing around my neck. For Christmas, my sister said she didn't have any money, and she gave me this. It's just a little doohinky on a chain, and it was in a box, and she had a beautiful little handwritten note, and it said that this was, my mother had given her this. I've never even seen it before, and she was passing it to me. It was my mother's mother gave it to her, and my mother gave it to my sister, and my sister passed it to me this Christmas. And my first thought, because I'm an alcoholic, I remember looking at my sister and thinking, how come Mom didn't give it to me? How come she gave it to her? And I was just pissed about it. And I'm the oldest. I'm the first girl. Why did my sister get it? Because I'm an alcoholic, and that's what we do. And I thank you for listening.
Okay. We have just a few minutes left. If anyone would like to ask Jan a question, we'd be happy to welcome those.
Cheryl Williams. She's kind of still my sponsor. She still kicks me in the butt. Well, Ione and I are going to Guatemala in May. Be my fourth trip. Ione's first, and she's a pretty adventuresome lady too, and I met her in this program. All in the program, and one of my friends was going to go, and I thought, how am I going to tell her none of us can? But she couldn't go, so it worked out. Pardon me? Dave knows my old sponsor and Hal. He knows him very well. He knows what it was. You know, if I could share one other thing. When I first got sober, I must have just been this sweet-looking little thing because Hal and Cheryl invited my husband and I to a barbecue. And we went, and everybody thought my husband was the drunk. And Reed said, why do they always think that about me? And I remember Hal sharing this story, and you may have heard it, Dave, and Linda may have heard it. Hal said they had moved from Truckee. They were both ski bums, and they both had many years in the program when I met them. And Hal said, I remember we were at a meeting in Truckee, and it was freezing cold, and it was snowing, and there was a new guy in the meeting, and he needed to detox. He wanted to get sober. So we put him in the car, and we drove him all the way to Reno, and we put him in this detox center, and then we had to go to work the next morning. We only got a half an hour sleep, and Hal said, "It doesn't get any better than that, Jan." And I remember looking at him and thinking, how lame is that? And Cheryl, my sponsor, knew me so well. I mean, she just would look at me and say, "One day, Jan, you will understand." And that took me a long time. I didn't learn this stuff. I was a very slow learner. You just got to be patient. Anything else?
Thank you.